Hi and welcome back. I'm Jerry Nixon.
I'm Darren May.
This is module 2 of the second day of 70383.
4 and 5.
4 and 5. Three, no, 383. This is 383. The first one was 384.
Doesn't matter. Moving on.
All right. Nonetheless, we're in Module 2. Welcome back. We're about to talk about the basics of XAML. We're going to get into Visual Studio. That was a lot of PowerPoint, Darren.
That was a lot of PowerPoint. I'm over PowerPoint. Are you over PowerPoint?
Well, there's still some things we have to talk about, but yeah, I mean, I'm not a big fan.
Okay. So what we're going to do is we just go through a couple of these introductory slides. You know, we're going to be touching on XAML basics.
Yeah.
Some interaction with the XAML code behind, and some XAML tooling. But without further ado, we're going to jump into Visual Studio. Over to Derry.
All right. There's so much in XAML. I mean, it hurts even to start talking about it right now because I know in 1 hour we're not going to be able to cover anything.
Yes.
And nonetheless, so let me pull up Visual Studio. I'm going to open up a. Go ahead.
So while you're doing that, you know, really, what is XAML? I mean, from an outset, what actually is XAML? I mean, I think one of the key things to understand is it is valid XML. You know, it is a document that has structure, has elements, and is valid XML. You know.
Agreed. Sorry, I had this moment of panic that C# wasn't installed. I'm sorry. Like, this is going to be a rough demo.
Proper prior preparation prevents.
It turns out it's under this visual C# tree.
Oh, that's a good one.
Where you would expect it. Okay.
Jerry can now breathe, and if we can move to his desktop, that
All
would
right.
be great.
You're right. It's valid XML. In fact, I'm going to open up a brand new project here. And it'll start at AppXAML, but I want to go straight to main page so that we can talk about it. There's two parts when you're editing XAML. Obviously, it's the XAML itself and the designer. I do want to just make this point that a lot of people tend to resist the designer, or at least used to, and that's because the designer used to be really bad. And
which is unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't as good as it could have been, I guess, is a more polite way to say it. But the reality is it was not good enough, right? Mm-hmm. And so we often avoided it.
So everybody used Blend.
Special. Yeah, so you would go to Blend, and Blend would have an excellent designer, very stable, very powerful, but developers tended to resist Blend because it was mostly dark, I think, is the reason.
Mostly dark. It was originally marketed towards designers rather than developers.
Yeah.
And the flip side of it is Blend had a pretty poor code experience.
That's right. So developers were confused. They didn't, why would I use Blend when it doesn't even have the IntelliSense that I'm used to, right?
Yep.
That's the idea.
So what's new in 2012?
Well, that's right. 2012, the designer is the same designer.
Yes, it's Blend.
Yeah. And so if you don't use the designer, that's up to you. If you do, now you hit that same high fidelity experience that you had in Blend.
Absolutely.
Right, so no reason to go to Blend for just the designer purpose. Certainly still reasons to go to Blend. We'll cover that in some of the modules later, but right now let's just talk about the basics of XAML. So here I am. I'm not going to look at the designer for now because I want to talk about the XAML side of things. Okay, so this is a page, and you said earlier that XAML is basically just XML, and that's right, it is. And specifically, not just XML, it is valid XML.
That's key.
Every tag, every element has a closing tag, every attribute has quotes around it, and I guess that's pretty much it.
That's pretty much
it. And you nest them properly.
And then the extensions to that are actually incorporated still as valid XML.
That's right. There's no syntax inside XAML that isn't valid XML. So the first thing I see is the page element here. And what is a page element, or what just does an element inside XAML represent, Darren?
It basically represents a class. It's something that can be instantiated, and not only in XAML, but also in code, which is very key.
No, you're right. So page is a class that's out there somewhere. It's in the framework, we know. So is grid. We know that that's out there as well. Since I know that that's a class, and what it's really doing is just setting the background and instantiating it, I guess I could do this in C# and totally avoid XAML if I wanted to?
You absolutely could. I mean, one of the key things that's to observe, though, when we're looking at this, is how succinct the expression of grid is. You're actually stating that grid's there. How do we know where grid comes from?
Mm.
It's those namespaces at the top there.
No, you're absolutely right. So grid, you can see, doesn't have a namespace. But I might add one. Let's add one so we can contrast between the two. So
you've got a default namespace up there. If you actually look, you've got XMLNS, the first entry, line 3. You've actually got a default namespace that actually has all the extensions for the XAML elements.
That's right. So if you see such as grid or page that doesn't start with a namespace like this one does with UI, then you know that it comes from the default namespace, and that's the one that doesn't indicate what that character is going to be because it doesn't need one.
Correct.
Right, so this is the default namespace, and so if you are looking for where grid is defined and where page is defined, you just go to this URL?
Nope. Unfortunately, these are specifications that it's just a unique string. There's nothing sitting out on the web that if you were to type in this URL, you're not going to get a document that reveals all about XAML.
Yeah. I mean, the reality is you would go into the framework, and it is actually
exactly. And then MSDN will tell you what you need to use.
Yeah, no doubt.
But that's not true for all of the namespaces up there.
No, it isn't. Which one were you thinking about? I want to talk about UI, but which one were you thinking about?
I'm thinking about line 5 there, where it has the local. So this is mapping into our actual assembly. So this is how we can access classes that we've defined within our application within the XAML code.
That's right. App 2 is the app that I just created. If I were to open up the Solution Explorer, you can see a couple interesting things. First of all, this is App 2. And that XAML itself has a friend, which is the C# here, right? So I have mappage.xaml, and I have mappage.xaml.cs. And that is where all of the work is done behind the scenes. But the and you can see the namespace behind the scenes, that's kind of where I was headed, is in App 2. So just like I would make a reference in C# with a using statement, the syntax is a using statement. That's pretty cool.
It is. It's pretty consistent.
Yeah. Now that's for my assembly or my current application. I just added the add control from the advertising SDK just to kind of show an external reference. So we added this reference right here inside the project. And then this is what it added for us automatically. This would be, if I were referencing the add control and code behind, this is exactly the using statement I would have. I would take the colon away, of course, but this is the using statement I would have, and it indicates where to go find it. And it's the project itself would know Microsoft that advertising WinRT UI is outside of the current assembly, and it's one of the referenced ones. Very powerful.
Very powerful. Why don't we drill into a little bit of the element syntax?
Yeah, let me take away this background so we can kind of talk about less of the namespaces and more of the functions. All right, so let's say I wanted to set a property. So we know that this is a class.
Yeah.
Classes have properties. Perhaps they also have events.
So when this gets run, what is the runtime environment doing when it sees this grid element in our XAML?
Yeah, you could almost ask, how quickly can you execute XAML, right?
Yeah.
And the reality is you do not execute XAML, right? XAML instead gets interpreted and then compiled down into the code that you would have otherwise written.
So what we're really saying is XAML gives us a very succinct and efficient way of declaratively specifying what we're going to have in our UI.
That's right. It's really a way of visually communicating to other developers as well as the designer how you want the UI to be laid out.
Perfect.
Yeah.
But that grid on its own doesn't seem to do much.
No, it doesn't. It looks a little bit like HTML.
It does.
It does.
Yeah.
The valid XML thing kind of separates it, as well as the fact that we're talking about C# classes in the back end.
Exactly.
All right. So, yeah, grid. So if I wanted to set a property, background as a property, I have more than just one way to do it. But what's the first way that everybody does?
The attribute syntax.
Yeah, using attributes.
You see? You say potato, I say potato.
Yeah, so if I did want to set background and I set it to blue, now this is interesting. First of all, it's convenient, right? I just type blue and it's done. If I were to do this in C#, I can't set the background to blue.
No. So that's a really interesting problem to solve. You want your XML to be very, very human readable. Mm. You don't want to have to create this vast array of nested syntaxes and so on and so forth. But how does the environment know to convert blue to what you actually want to put in there? And what do we usually put into a background color?
Usually a brush.
Yeah.
In fact, that's the type that it's expecting, either a solid brush, perhaps a linear gradient brush, one of those two. But if I pass just blue, it can interpret that for me, converting it into a solid color brush.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a type converter, yeah?
It's a type converter, exactly. If I were to say blue with two E's, it would fail. because it can't convert that into a solid color brush for me. If I wanted a linear brush instead of a solid color, I can't just say blue with, you know, blue comma white and it becomes a linear brush, right? That's not an option.
Yeah, that's not fancy. And anybody who's come to Windows 8 programming from the WPF world and so on and so forth, you might recognize the ability to do type conversions, and you might be familiar with the ability to create your own type converters. Presently, you cannot create your own type converters. Mm-hmm. You just need to leverage the type converters that are in the platform.
Yeah, which is still a bunch. I mean, you can still use value converters if you
Absolutely.
Need to.
In most situations, you can use value converters, and you're not really going to notice the loss.
And we'll talk about value converters soon.
Yeah.
All right, so let's say I did want to set the property to blue. I would just type it in. But if I did want to set it to a complex type, like I wanted to pass in a linear gradient, how would I do it? Because this is going to be the same routine for every property that I want to set as a complex type.
Well, the really neat thing about XAML is it gives you two syntaxes. Mm-hmm. You've got the simple property, which we've just expressed, but you've also got the ability to do the complex properties expression by virtue of using sub-elements.
Yeah. So this accomplishes the exact same thing we just did before.
Yeah.
Right. Now I'm explicitly setting background, and now I'm setting it to the solid color. There is no conversion here. I am actually instantiating a solid color brush with the color blue.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is the output of this is identical, and so you know the compiler that's interpreting the XAML and producing the code as part of the compilation process understands both of these syntaxes, and it gives you a very rich way to compose your interfaces.
So if I did want a linear gradient brush, obviously this is the way to do it, right? I can't jam it into an attribute syntax, but I can put it in a complex property type.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's really nice. A lot of power there as well. I think it's worth saying linear gradient brush is actually a great example. If I were to go to the properties of that, of course I hit F4, mm-hmm. if I go to the properties of this, then I could set the actual colors, or let me go to actually the grid. Then I could set the linear gradient brush really easily. Right, I'll go here, sorry. And I could set the, let's say I have two stops. The first one is going to be red, and the second one's going to be blue, right? This is nice because it kind of goes back to that power that we got bringing in the designer from Blend. That interface, that properties dialog, that properties pane is brought over from Blend. It's rich, it's powerful, it's nice. And look at the XAML it created for me.
Absolutely. I mean, you and I, we think in hex all the time, but some people might need these design tools to help with colors.
Right. Look how I nailed red perfectly, and look what it did.
I know. That's
good luck.
That was just awesome.
I mean, I didn't plan that. That's pretty awesome.
Exactly.
But
move on. Don't gloat.
There is a lot of power here in that. Imagine trying to type this. I mean, you could.
You could.
I've typed these manually myself.
Well, when we started, when the initial previews of WPF and Silverlight and so on and so forth, we didn't have all of these tools. And so we were using things like XAMLPad and so on to go in and construct these things by hand.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I did, in the WPF days, I did this by hand almost all the time because I hated the designer so much, right? I almost use the designer. I bet I use the designer 50% of the time now. Mm-hmm. It's really valuable. Yeah. You have to come in and tweak it by hand sometimes.
Yep.
That's okay. All right, what's another feature of XAML you want to cover?
How about content? You know, it's great having all of these things. We can style them and so on, but we probably want to show some information.
No, you're absolutely
right. How content is king.
Button is a pretty good content display here.
It is. It's something that's, unless you've played around with WPF and Silverlight, you might be thinking that button is a very constrained control. You know, it just looks like a button, you click on it. But au contraire.
No, you're absolutely right. And in fact, let me say click me. All right, so there we are. I've set the button content. This does look a lot like HTML. But
why don't we show that in the designer? What does it do?
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Now, to bring the designer back, by the way, if you have closed it, this is a pretty common question, is these little, at the bottom, right, so you have these tiny little things. And so you can change the split to be vertical or horizontal. All right, so here we are. Remember, I changed the colors. So let me just add the background back to be black again.
Because white on white is a little hard to see.
White on white was a challenge, exactly. And so I'll zoom in here. There it is.
So how are you zoomed in there?
I'm rolling my mouse while I'm holding control. But I, of course, could use this little drop-down as well if
yep,
I wanted to.
Perfect.
Yeah. All right. So having said that, there it is. It says click me in the middle. That's a standard button styled the way I would want to.
Okay. So what we've got there is we're expressing content between the closing or the begin and close element tags.
Yeah.
So is that the only way we can do that with a button?
No, it isn't. And there's some important pieces here in that content is especially in content controls around XAML, they are waiting for anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's weird to say that, but I mean, I could put anything inside a button, not just click me. I could add another button if I wanted to. Right, that seems crazy, but you can see there's a button inside a button now.
Yeah.
We're
kind of getting meta right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Which button clicks which button?
Yeah, don't do this. It makes it too confusing.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it's very cool. I could put images inside there or whatever it is that I want.
Why don't throw a rectangle?
Sure. How big do you want it?
Oh,
how about 100?
100 sounds good.
All right, we'll make it red instead of...
Yeah,
so it's really simple. Bam! There it is.
So there's another interesting thing that just happened there in terms of the control sized itself for its content.
Ah, yeah, that's exactly right. It wasn't originally 100 by 100.
Yeah.
So the sizing of a control is something developers need to think about as well, because it's controlled by things more than just what you tell the control to be.
Yeah. We're going to talk about layout a little bit more in terms of how layout is processed to a certain extent, but it's really important to understand these things.
Yeah. And just to, if I were to do a little preview of what we'll talk about soon.
That's it. My entire demo is now gone.
See, I can keep adding rectangles, right? And it just keeps going. Yeah, and
it'd be even better if they were different colors.
I'll make the middle one blue.
Okay.
How about that? Bam.
So there you can see, you know, just how flexible and powerful it is in terms of creating a user interface that nobody wants to interact with. But that's a different matter.
Yeah, exactly. It's like making the user stop clicking allow.
So that's one syntax for content. How about another syntax?
Another syntax. We could use the... this is what you're talking about?
No, you don't want that one. You want the attribute was the one I was going to talk about.
Oh, sorry. A period content?
Yeah. So we can also specify simple content via the attribute syntax.
Yeah, got it. All right. And so this is kind of going back to how we did blue and mm-hmm. how it naturally interpreted that to be what it expected. So the expectation of content in this syntax is string.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's what it's expecting, not a solid color brush, necessarily.
And also, this syntax is the syntax you'll use when you're binding. And we're going to touch on binding again in another presentation.
Could I put a rectangle here?
You can't put something that's just going to get evaluated, because that's just going to get translated as a string.
That's right. That's exactly right. Of course, we can't have closed tags is the reason that happened. But
exactly. None,
either way, you can't start putting complex types here. That's why you use the other syntax.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But thanks for showing that other one, the button... dot content as well, because that shows how you can, again, call out your attributes into nested elements.
Yeah, that's interesting. What's the difference between these two? And then with it explicitly as content?
No difference in reality.
No, they're exactly the same. Over here, they're just sitting on top of each other, so you can see they're side by side there.
Magic of the designer. So we kind of briefly touched on data binding. One of the key facilities that supports that is this notify property changed interface that, again, we'll be touching on in a future presentation.
Mm.
But there's a key thing that we need to understand about how these attributes get exposed up in this XAML designer.
Yeah. The iNotify property changed is an interface. It's mm-hmm. already part of the it's part of the framework that you use. And it's made whenever when you're doing a binding. So, for example, right now, the value inside button, and button is a silly one here, kind of, but is high, right? Hello. Mm-hmm. And so it will stay hello forever, right?
Yep.
I could give a name to this button, and then from code behind, I could say this button.content equals whatever the new content is.
Yep.
But that's not the ideal way to do it, right? The ideal way to do it is through a binding where I'm actually saying there's a class out there. It has a property. The value of that property is what I want to show inside this button.
Yes. We want these applications to be alive. Now, you would probably use a consistent term on a button because it would be confusing if over time you kept changing the command that was on a button. But if we're showing text boxes and so on and so forth, we don't expect to specify once and once only what's going to be in the text box.
Yeah, that's right. The iNotify property change then comes in to say if the value of that property changes,
yep.
reflect that in the UI. Mm-hmm. If you don't implement iNotify property change, you can change that property all you want in that class.
Yep.
The resulting UI doesn't pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what is common with all of these attributes that are being exposed out? You know, what type of properties are they? Are they dependent? Or dependency properties?
You can lead a fish to water.
But you can't make it sing.
All right, so, right. There are common CLR properties. I think that's important, right? Hello is text, right? And it's just a string. It's what you would think, and the reason it can be updated in a class is because it's iNotify property change. Mm-hmm. However, there are other things that need to happen. Like, for example, let me show a little bit about this grid. If I said grid dot, let me change this to be a canvas. Whoop. The Windows key is fun here. So if I change this to be a canvas, nothing would change except for the way that it now interacts and lays out. If I were to recreate that button, like so, and I wanted to move it around like this, the way that it moves it around is, look what it changes. It changes canvas.top and canvas.left, and that's the way that I indicate where inside the canvas I want it to go. Canvas dot is an indicator to me that this is not a property of a button, right? If I were to look at the button class implementation, there is no canvas.left. It's something special, and it's something that is added to this button to make it work inside a canvas.
Almost as if something has attached it.
Yeah. And so we call those attached properties.
Oh, that's amazing.
Excellent job, Darren. Absolutely excellent.
Just call me Mr. Segway.
attached properties allow the developer to identify a class like a button and add properties to it. It's a little bit like an extension method in C# where I can add methods mm-hmm. to a class, but this allows me to actually add properties to a some class or some object on the screen.
So the properties are declared on canvas, yeah?
No. The properties are declared in the extension of the UI element button. And so it allows me then to, because you'll see that canvas itself has canvas.top, but it doesn't mean anything for the canvas unless it's inside a canvas. And so it allows the parent to read what the children have in it. Right? You looked at me funny, but I wasn't sure where you were going.
Basically, the attached properties, you know, they're part, you know, it's part of the canvas class. You're pulling those attached property definitions from the canvas class, but the children can set values on them so that they're laid out.
Hmm. Fascinating.
Yeah, because in the code, you call canvas.setLeft and canvas.setRight.
At the, that's right. Or in the button, you'd do it as well, right? Mm-hmm. The what's more important, or not more important, but equally important,
yep.
is that these attached properties act like, because they are, mm-hmm. dependency properties.
Yes.
And so, first of all, I can extend an object with these attached properties so I can do more with it. You know, one example, real quick, might be an attached property you create is the ability to save a certain type of data, right? That you wish that data, you wish that button had the, I don't know, the XY coordinate of the mouse when they clicked it the second time or whatever, right? And so you can store that and it'll forever be stored with it, right? That's another use of an attached property. Mm-hmm. Because I can't go into and change button. I mean, I could override it, but yep. I don't want to do that, right? And subclass it. So that's the attached property. It really is a dependency property. Mm-hmm. And dependency properties are special really in two ways. And they're very special and they make XAML, they're kind of one of the benefits of XAML, no doubt about it. So imagine this, Darren, I have 1,000 elements on my UI. That's not unreasonable, right? You could do that, especially as you start making things really complex and neat looking. You could have 1,000 things, especially in a repeater. Those 1,000 things may each have 1,000 properties.
Yep.
And each of those properties will maintain some sort of memory space, right? Even if they're null, it's some sort of memory space. And so they get bigger and bigger, so it's 1,000 times 1,000 now.
It's a lot.
It's a billion. 1 trillion. And it's...
not your strong point.
Never do math on camera.
Yeah, it's more than 2.
Yeah. Anyway, the reality is it becomes exponentially large, and the memory usage would be, like, just terrible. So the idea would be...
It's just big.
Dependency properties solve the problem. They mm-hmm. treat properties instead like a property bag, is where you have a dictionary where you can pass in the name and you get back the value. That's a property bag. That's the way dependency properties work. That's the first value in that if I don't set the value, it's not there, which means I may have 1,000 properties. let's say the dependency properties, I've only set two of them. I only have to worry about the memory space of the first two properties, and I don't have to worry about the other 998. Yep.
They're also have a special syntax to them, you know, in terms of they're statically declared on the class, often backed by CLR properties.
Oh, yeah.
But that static declaration means they're readily available within an environment such as the designer.
That's right. And earlier, when we were talking about iNotify property change, that is another big value of dependency properties, too. Dependency properties natively implement that, and so they already have all of the events necessary to make sure that the UI is updated as well, right?
Yeah.
Dependency properties are important when it comes to animation.
Absolutely. Essential, one would say.
You could, yeah. You could animate non-dependency properties all you want, but you'd never see a result.
You're never going to see... You could attempt to animate, I think.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
There's no animation going on.
Indeed. So, yes, that's a key point, that when you're designing your classes, and if you are considering animation and visual state changes and so on and so forth, it's worthwhile just by default implementing them as dependency properties.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. In fact, I'm going to drop the code behind for a second here and create a quick class. This will be a public class called Darren, and it'll have a property
of awesome?
Of awesomeness. This is a rating system.
Oh, that's good.
You like that?
Yeah. I like it. It's only positive.
Yeah.
It should be a uint, unsigned int.
So I know that that's in local because I just created it, right? And Darren is, I can instantiate, why can I not see it?
Because you need to compile it.
I just did.
Yeah. Oh.
Well, no, now it's giving me that. Wait a minute. Don't go off subject. Don't go off.
So you've gone off the script.
I'm absolutely stumped.
So you know what we say then? We say move on.
You know what? Let's make this work. Now let's see what happens. Oh, well, I guess neither of us are awesome.
Yeah.
We needed a demo.
Oh, I tell you what it is. Look at your canvas top value.
That's what's causing it. We've already got a problem.
Yeah.
No.
No?
Boy. Stop trying to get me back in it. We're letting it go. The demo has proven it, and we'll move on from there. We were talking about dependency properties. I wanted to just show how I could set a property directly that's a CLR property, and it's stuck at that, right? And it will no longer impact the UI after it's already set. That's what I really wanted to show. And that's actually a common mistake that, you know, I get a lot of emails from developers with problems that they have. And that's a common mistake where they will create a class like Darren, right, where it holds some value and they're binding to it from other things. And so that way they can only animate one place, mm-hmm. but they've blown it because they didn't make it a dependency property.
Exactly. So if you go back to your code view there, why don't you bring up the document view and see the kind of hierarchy of elements?
Oh, yeah. The document outline?
Yes.
Ah, here we go. So that again, this is one of those panes that came over to us from right here. This is the one that came over to us from Blend. It's a brilliant little tool to be able to see the entire thing. Let me add a couple things. So I've got a button. I'll add another button. And then inside this button, I'll add another button. Right? We got three buttons. They're all nested. It's quite a UI.
It's awesome. Award-winning, one would say.
Award-winning. It's stunning. But, honestly... a page that is defined in XAML is perfectly hierarchical, mm-hmm. right? And this allows me to see that it starts from the page right here. This is the page on the left here. And then I go first to the canvas, which is where I would expect to go, and then on down. This UI, it's interesting that you have me go here, actually, because it's nice because I can hide things. You know, if they're getting in the way, I'm like, I really want to see just this button or just mm-hmm. you know that and its child or the one above it or whichever. It's nice because it allows me to kind of interact with it as well as lock it. So this lock allows me not to accidentally grab it and screw it up in the designer.
Yeah.
That happens a lot, you know, where you're doing that. Since all of these are sitting on top of each other, I might just point this out. You know, it might be hard to select the right one, get it just right, but I can right-click over all of them and then go to set current selection, and it'll navigate me down to the one that I want.
There's a lot of richness in this environment, that's for sure.
Yeah, since I don't have a name for any, it's kind of hard to tell them apart, but I could easily give it a name. Over here, I could give it a name like this. Darren's button. Now when I right-click it, you can see it's part of the selection.
Excellent. So anyway, the tree representation on the left-hand side seems like a very logical layout of the controls and their hierarchy.
It is. In fact, let's combine this idea of hierarchy and dependency property for a mm-hmm. second. If I were to set a dependency property on Canvas, let's say, one of the nice things about dependency properties is that they flow down the hierarchy. So we'll talk about this later, but a very important dependency property that most controls have is data context. And I can set the data context all the way up at the page level, and as soon as I do, that's the same as setting the data context on every control in the entire page as it flows down through the tree until it's intercepted. I can always set it again, mm-hmm. and then it'll flow down from there.
Yep.
But it's nice because it allows me to do things, especially when it comes to data binding, to do the initial data context on the page level or some sort of container. But when I look at that hierarchy, this one represents what we call the logical hierarchy. These are the things I literally typed in order to see, in order to create the UI. But if I go over here and look at the designer, right? The designer has far more than what I typed in, because the designer has a border that it's created. Mm-hmm. The designer is demonstrating the border that it's creating. It's demonstrating the container for high, right? It's going to be a little text block that's in there, and other pieces that need to make up the UI. And what I mean is, even though I typed in just button, what's rendered is far more, right? Lots of controls are needed in order to make
exactly.
a button
look right.
Exactly.
I mean, the text is probably inside a text block.
Right.
You know, it's a content control. And as you say, there's a whole hierarchy of objects that are being created behind the scenes in order to render that.
Now, what we're talking now is a new tree, right? Mm-hmm. So we have the tree that we have here we can see visually, but we also have this kind of tree that's created for us, right?
Which confusingly is called the
visual tree. We can see visually here, but the logical tree you can visually see. That's interesting.
Yes, don't say that.
Don't say that, because that's just confused. So there are two trees, the logical tree and the visual tree. And it's important to understand the difference, because they're referenced often, and then the way that you find objects in code. It might be important for you to go into a button and change its border dynamically through code somehow. Mm-hmm. The way you're going to go find that the border is going through the visual tree to find it that was actually injected into your UI.
Yeah.
You won't find it by name, because I never added a border in the first place.
Yep, absolutely. And there are some helpers and so on. We're not going to spend any time really going into navigating the visual tree in code or anything along those lines, certainly not in this day's presentation. But there's definitely some very interesting scenarios that you can leverage to go and find these components, change them out, do some different interactions with them.
Nobody navigates the logical tree in code.
No.
You just go to the control that you want.
Exactly.
It's the visual. So when you talk about the helper, there's a visual tree helper. And there's not a logical tree helper, because it wouldn't make sense, right?
Exactly.
It would not be logical.
It would be illogical. Moving on, Captain.
Excellent. All right. Okay, what else can we talk about?
So you started talking about there all of these elements that are part of the control that are used in rendering. And so that is actually something that's defined in some templates and other resources and so on that are shared. Mm. Just touch on briefly those, although we're obviously going to move on to those in a little while.
Yeah, but I think it's important to say that if you're an HTML developer, right? Mm-hmm. It's nice to go back to that reference.
Yeah.
If you're an HTML developer or some sort of web developer, then you already know that the styles that you use to make the make controls look the way you want is handled through CSS, right? A combination of properties on your control in CSS. It's very similar to how XAML handles it as well. We call it styles. We mm-hmm. don't call it CSS. But at the same time, those styles, just like you can share CSS across multiple controls so you don't have to write it twice, we can share styles across multiple controls as well. Just like CSS can be pulled out and put into a file so it can be shared across different web pages, we can do the same thing. We can take styles that we create to make controls look however you want to, move those up into files, and share those across the entire application or just specific pages inside that application as well. That's a type of shared resource. We don't have to share just styles, of course. We can share scalar values like numbers and colors and font sizes and all kinds. I mean, anything that you can put here, you can put into a resource, give it a name, and share it across any of the pages in the application.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So in a similar vein, when we're talking about those shared resources, I mean, if we go and have a look at your button, and say you've got a button with a rectangle inside it.
All right. I'm going to put a rectangle inside this one. Go ahead.
So say we've decided that this is something that's thematic to our application, and we need to be showing this throughout the application. Now, you could copy this code and drop it into every page that you're going to have one of these buttons, Or you could encapsulate this XAML into something that's reusable, such as?
Such as a content template.
Or a user control.
Or a user control. You could do it. Not a content, it would be a control template anyway.
Yeah.
So I could, there you go. You're leading me into
it.
I'm just like, where, what is it? I'm sorry, it's my fault completely. Right, so a user control. Another way to reuse UI. In fact, that's an important way. I mean, I think developers are accustomed to user controls. Certainly ASP.NET developers are accustomed to user controls. Reusable views, reusable pieces that maybe they're very complex. And the reason you want to reuse it is because it's so complex. Or maybe the reason you want to reuse it is because it repeats with data and shows in different places. So that's a very valuable piece. User controls are just like a XAML page. They're just a fragment. Mm-hmm. And I can bring in as many as I want from my current solution or my current project, I mean, or other assemblies, and they're referenced just like that add control that we added at the beginning.
So how is a user control contrasted to a custom control?
Oh, well, that's a good question. So here, let me create a quick user control and show you. So I will say add new item, right? I'll say user control. This will be called a red rectangle. I would never really do that. RECTANGL. God gravy. There it is. All right. So this is a red rectangle. The user control is going to be filled with a rectangle. Fill red. There you go.
That makes a lot of sense.
It's a heck of a control.
Boom.
There it is. Because I'm tired of typing red over and over and over. All right. So now, if I were to go back to the toolbox, here's the add control I added. But this is referencing my app that I'm in right now, or my project. There's the red control red rectangle user control I added. I can bring that in and drag. Oh, I could have also, of course, taken it to the designer. I didn't have to do it straight into the code. I could do it like this as well, right? In fact, it might be more interesting to do it that way. Because then it starts giving it size and stuff. And then I can resize it. And as long as I've built the user control so that it can handle different orientations and sizes, then it'll just keep maintaining with me as well. So that's nice because then I can do this. I can start repeating it over and over. You can see the code is
just. So what are you doing to just create those copies?
I am holding down Alt. So inside the designer, I hold down Alt, grab it, and drag it. Hold down Alt, grab it, and drag it, just like that.
Perfect.
Yeah. Of course, over here, it's copy-paste. Right?
Exactly.
That's Control-C and Control-V.
Awesome.
Bam! Just like that.
Okay, so you kind of touched on a little bit around templates, control templates, and so on and so forth. Why don't you show some examples of what those templates could look like, say, on the button?
Yeah, you bet. Using a control template. Yeah, absolutely. So let's say the button here. Well, let's talk about templates first.
Yeah.
Like what I'm about to do.
Yeah.
This is probably one of the most powerful things you can do inside XAML. So inside every control, let's step back even farther. Every control in XAML is the same control.
Ultimately.
And then from that point, it might be given a name, and it might be given a few extra methods, a few extra events, a few extra properties.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it's also given a template. And so those two things are important. One, that all these controls are basically the same control, and they all have a template. And the template is basically saying this is the way it's supposed to look in the UI.
Yeah, and you can explore those templates in the control.
Yeah, so here's my button right here. If I were to right-click my button, I could say edit the template. And of course, there is no template exposed, so I would have to make a copy of the current one.
So you're taking a copy of the master one or whatever's currently been applied.
That's right. It's actually very handy because it goes into the framework for me, pulls out the template, and then adds it to the inside the XAML.
So it becomes a local resource that you can use.
It does. So if I were to select it, such as that, right, I'll call it the button style 1. I'll make it inside this document and just say go. We'll talk a little bit more about styles later.
Absolutely.
But what makes this powerful, and so here it is. I'll just collapse it real quick. So you can see it goes from line 10 to 83. So there's 73 lines there that got pulled out all
good
the
math.
XAML. Thank you, on camera. And so these are all the pieces that make the button look the way it looks. It mm-hmm. is not the part that makes the button act like a button.
So this is a really key thing because you're really touching on this context of lookless controls that give us that flexibility. It's not like you used to do where you had a bitmap. Mm. And that bitmap was your look and feel for your control. Now these things are expressed in a manner that you can override.
That's right. And so earlier we were talking about user controls and the fact that we can encapsulate all of this functionality. But for a second, you kind of went to
custom controls.
Custom controls, thank you. Custom controls. And custom controls are interesting when you talk it in the context of templates, because a template allows you to change the way it looks, but not the way it acts.
Mm-hmm.
But a custom control allows you to change the way it acts. And so sometimes I don't want to change the way a button acts. It clicks. It, everything's good about that. I just want to make it so that all buttons from this point forward are circles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Great. I'll go in and I'll change the template. But I might want to make it so they have a triple click and a quadruple click and a whatever else. So then I go and create a custom control that inherits from button and overrides the properties and methods inside it.
I mean, that's a key point. You know, you probably always want to be inheriting from some form of control when you're creating your own custom, because there's a lot
off.
Of legwork that's done in actually building out that baseline implementation. So whenever you're building your custom controls, always look for what is my control most like that's already in the framework. And then look at, okay, does that have a base class or do I just want to inherit directly from there? So that's a key top tip. But as you mentioned, we're going to dive into templates in a lot more detail later on.
Right. That's kind of why I'm not pulling it open. Just know that everything that's necessary to make it work, and it is actually a very good educational experience to pull one of these templates out, look through all the stuff they had to do to make a button. Make
exactly.
Something as simple as a button. Do whatever you need to. And so if you need to dive into, of course, this is really referencing the visual, what will be in the visual tree as well, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you're going to see this. If you do need to change certain things, sometimes pulling out the style is the easiest and neatest way to be able to know how to dive into a control and make a small change to it.
One of the other things...
beware, though.
Beware.
As soon as you retemplate a control, the old template won't be used. So you can't reduce the functionality and assume it's going to be there. You may have a template where the template is just a rectangle. If you don't do all the visual states, the click handlers, the mouse over,
mouse
hover,
overs, all that.
It's not going to be there.
Yeah, and so that's interesting. You know, you can break things, but that's why I think we're really recommending going in and experimenting with these things. Create some copies of the existing styles. See the complexity there, because that gives you a lot of insight into how these things are implemented and gives you clues, really, on how to approach building your own controls. And again, we'll touch on that a little bit later in terms of the templates and so on.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we talked about a little bit earlier, where we were, say, putting in a hard-coded click or high inside a button, you know, that's great if you're just targeting English speakers, if you're just targeting the United States and so on. But there's some other capabilities that are in the platform around making it localized.
Yeah, I think it's worth at least a discussion that says that localization is important, right? We're talking about building Windows 8 apps. Windows 8 apps are what you deploy to the store, publish to the store, and then those are then made available to anybody who wants to find them. Anyone in any country, as a matter of fact. You get to choose when you publish to the store which country it's available in. And if you make it all in English, say, right, which would be, I would be tempted to do that, right?
I think so.
I think I would.
Well, certainly American anyway.
That would be very nearsighted of me, right? Mm-hmm. Because I wouldn't, of course, Windows is a worldwide platform. And Windows 8, the store, now more than 230 different countries, 70-some languages. I mean, it really is a powerful breadth that you can take advantage of. As soon as you make it just one language, then you really start to slice out the opportunity that you may have for your application to reach a broader audience.
Absolutely.
How do you localize?
So there's a interesting feature that's been developed right into this platform now. And we're going to touch on this, not so much detail now, but in the more advanced session that's going to follow at the end of May, we're going to touch on localization. But you have an extension called UID. That allows you to mark up an element to say that this now has a specific UID that I can refer to in a strings resource.
Yeah. And I think a string resource is a file, right, that basically says this is the element and this is what it should say.
The element property.
That's
one of the real key things with the enhancement to localization that's occurred in this platform. Is there's a recognition inherent in localization that a word that's in English may be much longer in another language. Yeah. And so not only do you want to change the text that you display, but you also may want to change the sizing of the controls and so on.
You may want to switch it from right to left instead of left to right.
Absolutely. And so these properties can be influenced in your localization file as well as merely the translation. which is very, very cool. But as I say, you know, we're going to go into that in more detail in the advanced session at the end of the month rather than here. We just don't have enough time.
I think the takeaway is XAML has it built in now for localization.
Yeah.
And it is actually a simple thing to do once you get past that hurdle of how do I do it, right? Once
exactly.
you're in it, you're like, ah, this is nothing.
Yeah, this is a piece of cake.
So we've talked about dependency properties and their ability to flow down through the hierarchy. Mm-hmm. We've talked about dependency properties, their ability to save memory footprint. We've talked about dependency properties and their relationship to attached properties so that we can extend other classes or other objects or controls on the in the UI so that we can use them.
Yep.
We didn't talk about event handling, do we want to?
We didn't talk about event handling, nor did we talk about how when you're actually creating these controls in XAML and you're viewing them in the designer, it's the real thing.
Yeah,
and how important the constructor is in that.
Yeah, well, let's do that first because that's totally awesome. All right, so when I reference the button here and I see it over here in the designer, it is executing the class, it is instantiating the class, executing its constructor. So if inside that button, there inside the its constructor, it said something like this dot background equals blue, in the designer, it's going to be blue.
And that's the key thing is the button, the whole layout system is rendering that control live on that design surface.
Yeah.
It really is. It's not some facsimile of the button. That is exactly how that button has been implemented and how it's going to present.
Yeah. And so that gives you a lot of power when you're creating your own control to have design time data.
Yeah.
Right?
So
you may have something like a view model or a custom control that you have, and you want it to look a certain way in the designer so that the developer can interact with it. Even though they can't reach out to their web service, they can't whatever, you can still provide an interactive, not interactive, but a
default experience, really.
A full experience, yeah.
Why don't you show that?
Sure, absolutely. So I'll do it with a view model.
Yeah,
all right.
Sounds good.
A class named Darren.
Oh,
boy.
No.
All right, so if I did create a class, I'm nervous all of a sudden.
I know.
But it didn't work last time.
I know.
We'll
that's
make
where
it,
I see you dance.
While I'm talking, what's a view model?
So we're going to touch on this more in binding, but effectively, a view model is data that's shaped for presentation in a specific view. So you might have a web service that gives you the weather, and it might have hundreds of parameters and very rich information, but you just want to show the temperature. A view model would take that background data and shape it for presentation to expose out one or two properties, however many you wish to display. And so it's a model that's specific for a given view. We then leverage that using data binding to present information. And so we can, there's a separation of concerns here that goes on as well in that the view model is just interested in data and the view is interested in how to present that data. And so by having a view model, we can turn around and say we expose up a message that says hello, whereas the view is just concerned with how is it going to present a message.
Yeah, all right, so that's right. And that's that. Let me try and demonstrate what you just explained. And so the first thing I'll do is I'll go to the properties of the page and I'll look to see what its data context. So when we're talking about binding, data context is really going to be it. So we're going to talk about binding more explicitly later. So I'm just going to rush through this and say, watch the next one if you really want to understand binding. So I'll add the view model to it. And what's nice is inside the constructor, I go ahead and set the property of title. So it already has a value. It's not going to be an empty string. If I didn't set, of course, it would be an empty string, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And so here I can add the binding to it. I'm going to do it all in the
designer
here because it's a nifty thing. So I say, so I click this little box to the side of text, which is what I want to set. And I want to change it to be a data binding. It already recognizes that I'm inside a view model. And I'll say title. How does it recognize that I was already inside a view model? Because I set the data context of the page.
And it's inherited.
And it's inherited through the entire hierarchy from this point forward. And
dependency properties in action.
Yeah. So I'll delete hello, because that doesn't make sense. And now, look, it says my name is Jerry, which is inside C. So it is executing the C sharp.
So basically by turning around and saying you needed the view model up in your resources there and binding it to data context, it's creating an instance even though we're in design time.
Yeah, this line 11, literally is the invocation of the class.
And that's really, really powerful.
I think this is probably an important one too, Darren. If I change this to Darren and switch back, it still says Jerry.
Why is that?
It's because the designer does not read my C sharp. The designer reads my DLL. And so it doesn't see the change until I actually do the build. So I'll hit F6 here to build. It will build it, it'll cause it to refresh, and then you'll see the change.
And so that's the important thing, is it genuinely is running the code, and the code can only be run if it's been compiled.
As a word of warning, you can't do everything in a constructor during the design time.
Yep.
If you want to call out to a web service, that's a failure. If you want to read a file, that's a failure.
Yep.
You got to do simple code.
There are some properties that you can check to see whether you're in design time. So you can actually check for design mode and so on and so forth. So you can input these static strings. The advantage of design time data is it gives your designer and developer the ability to model how something's going to look without necessarily hooking up databases, web services, and so on and so forth.
If this text block was blank until I actually ran it,
you'd have no idea.
No, and a run could take 10 seconds, 20 seconds, and think of that as I tweak it.
So we've mentioned Blend a couple of times throughout. Why don't you open this up in Blend?
So Blend comes with Visual Studio now. It's not a separate install. If you have Visual Studio 2012, then you already have Blend. And so I can go to here's my XAML page, main page. I can right-click and just say open in Blend. As soon as I do, it opens it in Blend. It doesn't open just the page either. It opens the entire project, just like your Visual Studio. That's because as I make changes here that need to have project scope impact, it does it for me, just like Visual Studio. Mm-hmm. It's not a...
So you can see your user control in here as well.
I can indeed. Yes, I can. Right there.
Exactly.
Oh, you're wanting me to show it. Oh, I could drag it in, just as if I was in Visual Studio. Of course,
exactly.
This is the same designer.
So it's the same designer. It looks different because it's black, but you can change the theme if you're not so comfortable with the dark themes and so on and so forth. So,
by the way, this is pretty cool because it does allow me to switch through all the different visual states as well as what would this look like on a 27-inch screen.
Right? Yeah.
That's really neat.
Yeah. So there's a lot of great facilities. As you say, almost all of these are available in the designer within Visual Studio.
Everything we've shown so far is.
What's the unique capabilities? Why would I need to come into Blend if I was a developer?
There is no other developer tool for XAML developers to allow you to easily and seamlessly create animations and storyboards, to be able to create and manipulate view states, right? And we'll talk about those later, but actually we'll talk about them in the next session altogether because they're very, very advanced. But that is really where Blend shines. If you want to see, if you want to be able to build all of those without having to by hand do every single state change and everything, every little decimal just right, because you can always use Notepad, right?
Yeah.
You always can. But if you want to make it easy, you want to make it visual, you want to play out the animation without running your application, Blend is the only solution for developers.
Okay, so let's kind of recap what we've covered. And we kind of went through XAML basics and really talked about the foundational syntax and how we can start to construct these XML, valid XML documents that express and declare what our user interface is going to look like.
Yeah. And then how we can use styles, and we can share styles across, and we can use different pieces to completely change the template of the control, because every control exposes a way for developers to reskin them to match the needs of their application.
Yeah, we kind of talked about the richness of the tooling that is available to support our construction and manipulation of XAML, and we kind of introduced the concept of code behinds and data binding.
Yeah. Which is fundamental. Of course, in data binding, we created a view model that is representative of MVVM, the data pattern, and that's the one that we, of course, always use with XAML as well.
Yeah. And as we said before, this is a very expensive subject in and of itself, that there are a vast number of controls or a vast number of capabilities to explore in this area. We certainly encourage everybody to go out and look at these resources and so on. We're going to be touching this throughout the rest of today in terms of constructing user interfaces and so on and so forth, but it really is key to understand these foundations.
Yeah. In fact, let me say this one thing, and I think this is worth saying to anybody who's listening. First of all, we know that XAML is rich. We know that it's amazing. We know it's cool. We know we didn't cover it all. But it might be in the back of your mind is it worth actually learning XAML? What's the future of XAML? How broad is it? And I think it's important to step back and look at the landscape of all of the different products inside the Microsoft platform. And now every single product leverages XAML to build its UI. On the Xbox, you can use XAML. Mm-hmm. On Windows, of course, we're using XAML right now. On the phone, on embedded, all the way across, you have options that include XAML. And in many places, XAML is your only option, like the phone right now.
Absolutely.
And so I think that's important. I mean, this is really the core UI technology for the Microsoft platform. And not only, I mean, conveniently, it's very powerful and very easy to use, but it's also very vast and very, you know, there's a good life in XAML.
That's great. Well, should we take a break?
Let's take a 10-minute break, come back to Module 3, and we will see you in 10 minutes.